I feel the need. The need for a podcast exploring the films and career of Tom Cruise. Welcome to Cruise Views. Feels like I haven't done that in ages.
I mean, we literally watched this. I watched this a month ago. It's fine. It's absolutely fine.
I rewatched it today. You should have done a little rewatch. It's very interesting on the rewatch. Anyway. Hello, welcome to Cruise Views, the podcast where we try and find out how Tom Cruise became one of our last ever movie stars by watching all of his films in chronological order. This week, we're continuing into 1999 for the Stanley Kubrick film, Eyes Wide Shut. It's mad that it's a Stanley Kubrick film. I'm Adam Scott Glasspool. I'm joined, as always, by sex fiend Tom Ashford.
Wow, that's caught me by surprise. Yeah, how you doing, Adam?
It's nothing to do with the film. That's how I'm going to introduce you for every episode from now on, I think.
War of the Worlds, sex fiend, Tom Ashford. Great.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm warm. Shall we mention how warm it is?
Yeah, I was going to say, I am shirtless and very sweaty.
Yeah, but again, that's the same for every episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even it reminds me of the first time we ever podcasted together, about 10 years ago or something. Mm. And that was similarly insanely warm. So this feels like, you know, it feels like we're coming home, you know. It feels like a reformation of the band.
Yeah. Well, we do have a band, Adam, and we performed once live in a living room and have never performed again. Yeah. But the album's coming.
I was thinking about that the other day because didn't it form on the same day as we recorded that podcast? We were playing cards and it was incredibly warm. Anyway,
yes.
Look, we don't need to talk about our forever forthcoming band, never arriving, always forthcoming. What have you been watching? I haven't spoken to you in like over a month.
Yeah. Okay. So I've seen a couple of films in the cinema. One being, I believe you've seen it as well, Elvis.
Sure.
What did you think of Elvis?
Real mixed bag, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Real mixed bag. I thought he was very good, Austin Butler.
Yes.
He just was Elvis.
Yep.
All of the best bits in the film were when you just got to watch him being Elvis, like doing the 68 comeback special or on stage in Vegas. And you're like, fucking hell, I'm watching Elvis, but you're not. You're watching Austin Butler play Elvis. And then I thought the worst parts of the movie were everything else.
Yeah. I mean, I went in thinking it was going to be like really bad. Like my wife really wanted to watch it, and I just thought,
well, I thought it was going to be really bad. Yeah, but it was better than I thought it was going to
be. Yeah. I was really pleasantly surprised. Not like overwhelmed. I gave it like 3.5 stars, but like it was good. But I kind of felt like everything in the film was pretty good, even like this relatively like breakneck pace that it had to cover everything in his life.
Oh God, it was just like a 2.5 hour long trailer.
Oh yeah.
Like a Twitter fan cam. I saw one person write about it.
At least that meant that it wasn't like, it didn't drag. It was constantly moving on to the next thing.
No, it didn't drag at all.
No, but the one really bad thing, the one thing that I can put my finger on and go, that's what wasn't good. Tom Hanks.
What is Tom Hanks doing in that movie?
It's like everyone
else. He's playing the Penguin from Batman.
Like, given that, like,
Austin Butler.
Austin Butler. I've never seen him in anything else. But anyway, Austin Butler is playing, like, a very much larger than life person.
Yeah.
And he's playing it as, like, grounded and realistic as he can. Everyone else is playing realistic. And Tom Hanks is playing a caricature. It doesn't fit the film.
It's really bizarre. It's a crazy Tom Hanks performance in a crazy movie. I didn't really like it, but it did remind me of how many great songs Elvis has as well.
Yeah.
Like, what a load of bangers. And I watched something recently that I also know that you've seen and felt very positively about that did the same thing, except this time for an artist that I had no idea about at all. I watched the Sparks Brothers.
Yes.
Now, what an interesting band.
Yeah, I knew nothing about them when I watched it.
This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us. Yeah, that's all I knew.
And I remember that as a silly song that my dad used to listen to.
Yeah, I thought they were like a novelty band, but they're so much more than that, aren't they?
They're great. I listened to every single album in order after watching that documentary, which is 24 albums. Yeah.
Why didn't you? You need to be on Music Board, mate.
Is that Letterboxd?
That's Letterboxd, but for music. Yeah, me and friend of various podcasts that I do, Chris Izzard, is on Music Board. He does some great reviews. Yeah, you should. That's a real odyssey. Why didn't we do a podcast about it, Tom? That's insane. Why are you wasting good content by simply just enjoying something?
I know. Unbelievable. Well, bring me on. What is music? Kick Lucas off because he doesn't know what he's fucking talking about. Get me in for that season.
We should just swap you round. It would be absolutely. It would make no difference to either podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about Elvis or the Sparx Brothers or a film I rewatched a couple of days ago, Uncle Jam. We should talk about, because I don't know, we might be talking about it forever. This might be a 5-hour episode. We're here to talk about the 1999 film. That's really difficult. 1999 film, Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah. Tell us about Eyes Wide Shut. I've got no idea when it came out, for instance.
Or don't you?
Who directed it, or who wrote it, or who starred in it, Tom.
It's one of those weird films that just passes you by, and you don't know about it. It's made by normal director for normal people.
He's so normal, this director. Everything I've read about this director and the production of this film, I've looked at it and gone, that seems very normal.
Yeah, he's kind of like a Ron Howard. You know, he's reliable, he's normal, he's relatively
You wouldn't
boring.
Call him an auteur, would you?
No, he's no. someone you just get in because you need like a session director to just sort of finish
exactly.
a project for you.
Someone who's going to bring it in on budget, yeah. on time.
If he was alive
not have
today,
anything weird in it. Yeah, yeah.
If he was alive today, he would have done Solo, A Star Wars Story. He would have finished
definitely.
That off.
Definitely. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I imagine they would have got him in to do... to do The Force Awakens, you know, and then realised that they'd made a mistake with the middle one and then got him back to do Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah, 100%.
Stanley Kubrick's The Rise of Skywalker. Can you imagine?
Would it be 2001 A Space Odyssey? It just wouldn't reference anything else.
With like laser swords. That's great. Anyway, then, yeah, what's going on?
Right. It comes out on the 13th of July, 1999.
Big that, summer movie. That's
that
when you release
premiere.
Your movie set at Christmas.
Yeah. Of course, we had to wait until the 3rd of September, so when the heat's dying down.
Yeah, I remember.
Do you? Actually, yeah. As soon as I was thinking of Kubrick, I was like, you weren't fucking alive when Kubrick was around, you idiot, Adam.
Isn't it mental?
You're being silly. You're doing a bit. No. I was almost 11 when he died.
I know. I feel like I do have vague memories of this movie coming out. Yeah. So directed by Stanley Kubrick is what we're
saying.
Yeah.
Have you heard of him or any of his movies before, Adam?
Yeah. This is quickly becoming my favourite bit of the podcast, though, is where we talk about incredibly famous directors and then figure out what you have and haven't seen.
Right.
And I've got gaps in Kubrick. I've got gaps in Kubrick as well. But what do you know about Kubrick before we get onto his films?
Well, despite having actually been to a Kubrick exhibition in London and having seen loads of the props, including the masks and cloaks from Eyes Wide Shut,
oh, cool.
And the typewriter and script from and axe from The Shining, and the giant floating baby from 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Of course. Spoilers.
And obviously,
2001: A Space Odyssey.
Well, I know it's only been what like 50 years. Jesus, maybe more. Oh, Christ, I don't know.
It's 54 years, I think. Yeah.
Jesus. So I saw loads of stuff like that. I don't really know a lot about his. Personal life.
I'm not interested in his personal life.
I know that he filmed a lot of stuff in the UK because he didn't like to travel.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's also a very particular man, right?
Yes. Yeah.
He's very controlling.
Yeah.
Very precise.
He's one of the few directors who could basically just, you know, spend a million years getting one shot right, and other people, the actors, won't complain.
He is entirely devoted to film as an art. And who does this sound like, Tom?
Hmm. It might sound like our boy Tommy C.
It really does. It really does. It actually doesn't make sense that they would work together, right? Like, because they both want individual control.
Yeah, unless Tom Cruise was essentially like, this is the one director I would not even question the decisions of, even at this point in his career.
That is essentially what happens here, yeah. He completely gives himself over to Stanley Kubrick because he's collecting his directors still. Mm. And, you know, it's Stanley Kubrick. Tom Cruise loves cinema. This is Stanley Kubrick. And I think Kubrick liked the appeal of them, you know, of Tom and Nicole being a real-life, very famous couple that were going to be in his drama that explores what it's like to be a couple, to be a married couple. I mean, you know, Cruise loving cinema probably means he's seen all of Stanley Kubrick's films by the time he got to work with him. Nowadays, Cruise has his guys. Like, let's talk about Kubrick. He started off doing like weird 50s stuff, right?
Yeah. I haven't seen them, going to be honest. I haven't seen the early stuff.
No, I haven't seen a lot of that early stuff. And I haven't seen the two films that he did with Kirk Douglas either. Paths of Glory and Spartacus. And then he did two films with Peter Sellers, Lolita and Doctor Strangelove. And I haven't seen Lolita either.
I mean, I haven't seen either of those.
Interesting. Doctor Strangelove is unsurprisingly very good.
Oh, yeah, I know. To be honest, any Kubrick film I would happily watch. Usually it's just a case that they're not on like streaming services, so I just never like think to put them on, if that makes sense. Like if I found Doctor Strangelove on Netflix, I'd just be like, yeah, give that a go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they, you know, you kind of have to hunt out the 4K Blu-ray these days. Yeah. You know, that's how his films should be watched anyway. Already at that point, he was like a divisive figure, not in terms of like quality of films, but how, like his need to control everything. And he would do so many takes of things. And he famously has loads of conflicts with the actors that he works with. But from Doctor Strangelove on, it's just kind of like some of the most influential films of all time, and they're all in a row.
Yeah. And some of which really I might have even seen.
Go through them. Tell me what you've seen and what you haven't seen.
Okay. Now, I have some of them written down. I can't tell you if there's gaps in there, for example. But I have seen 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Widely regarded as one of the greatest films ever made.
Yes.
I mean, it's pretty good.
It got 5 stars from me, Adam.
Oh, it got 5 stars from me as well. Absolutely. Yeah.
I have also seen A Clockwork Orange.
Yes. A film which has its own notoriety. Interestingly, don't really rate A Clockwork Orange. Or at least I don't rate it up there with some of his other work.
I haven't seen it for many, many years, so I couldn't really pass judgment on it.
Mostly kind of famous for being banned in the UK, right?
Yeah, which I don't think it actually was. I think he pulled it from distribution.
Oh, interesting. Because they were demanding cuts?
No, I think there was a lot of controversy around it, and then possibly, you know, newspapers and people doing a Republican Party and going, oh, it's causing all these violent things that aren't necessarily connected whatsoever.
And sure, that's like, doing well, a Republican Party, is it? Right, okay,
yeah, cool. There's a school shooting. It's probably a musician.
I think the next one, similarly for both of us, is A Gap, which is Barry Lyndon.
Yes, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I haven't seen Barry Lyndon. That's my last of the imperial phase of Kubrick that I need to complete. And then obviously you've seen The Shining, Tom.
Obviously I've seen The Shining, Adam.
Of course you've seen The Shining. Probably the second best horror film ever made for me.
What's the first one?
The Exorcist.
All right, fair enough.
Have you seen The Exorcist?
I have, though not for a long time. But obviously a classic.
Yeah, I remember watching it when I was young because it was like, I don't know, like infamously scary, I guess, and like gory or whatever. It had that aspect to it. Tom, it's one of the best films ever made. Honestly, it's incredible. And then, have you seen Full Metal Jacket?
I have.
Good film.
Yeah.
Good. 5 stars from me.
Film.
Good film. it's almost boring to talk about Kubrick, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's
we're not going to turn around and go, Full Metal Jacket. Thought it was a bit shit.
Yeah, a bit shit. The Shining is 1980. Full Metal Jacket is 87. And then there's nothing for 12 years. And then it's Eyes Wide Shut. And
which is mental.
Yeah. 12 years of nothing. And I think a lot of people consider Eyes Wide Shut to be one of his weaker films, right? Or especially compared to the ones we've listed just before it.
No spoilers. Well, I mean, it is a spoiler, but sorry for spoilers, I guess. But it's probably the lowest rated film out of his catalogue that I've seen, for me personally.
Right, yeah. I think...
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a damning review. It just basically means it wasn't as good as the five-star films we've listed.
Yeah, it wasn't as good as some of the greatest films that have ever been made.
Yeah.
Yeah. 2001 is 1968. Yeah, it is 1968. So it has been 54 years. In the 30 years after that, he made five films. Including Eyes Wide Shut. In 30 years, that's crazy. Did he write this as well?
He did. He co-wrote it with Frederick Raphael. Or Raphael.
I think it's Raphael.
I know, but I like now that I've seen that it's like Rachel, but with a P. It's Raphael. Frederick Raphael, and it was based on Arthur Schnitzler's novel.
Yeah, it was just called Traumnovelle, right? Or Dream Story. Yes, that plays into it quite a bit. I can't remember who's in it, Tom.
Well, it's Tommy C, otherwise we wouldn't be covering it.
Yep.
We've got Nicky Kay.
Oh, bloody Nicky Kay.
For a second, I actually forgot when reading that was Nicole Kidman.
Okay.
I was like, who did Nicky Kay play? Oh, yeah, for fuck's sake. Oh, it's very hot here, Adam. My brain's melting.
Don't understand your own notes.
listeners can probably hear my fan. It's 37 degrees Celsius. We're getting close to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm so sweaty.
That is too warm, isn't it?
Yeah. We got Todd Field as Nick Nightingale.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Sydney Pollack as Victor Ziegler.
Well, now, where have we seen Sydney Pollack before?
Oh, he directed the firm.
Where have we not seen him?
Yeah.
We're weird. The director of The Firm is kind of like the third biggest role in this movie.
And we also have Thomas Gibson making a return from Far and Away.
Who the fuck did Thomas Gibson play?
He played Stephen Chase.
Who's Stephen Chase?
That's Nicole, the man who is betrothed to Nicole Kidman.
Billy Zane?
Yeah.
Right.
And this
who did
time
Billy
he plays
Zane
Carl.
Play in this?
Carl.
Who's Carl?
The husband of the random woman that wants to kiss Tom Cruise.
Oh, right.
Because...
His name's Carl, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's Billy Zane?
Yeah, apparently.
Should we refer to him as Billy Zane?
Well, we're not going to talk about him at one point in this description, are we? Let's be honest.
I think we might. I think we all might talk about him once. Maybe once. He's in a scene, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it's quite a small cast because it's all Tom Cruise, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The entire narrative follows him from his perspective, which obviously perfectly marries with the, you know, like the character's journey, because it's all about indulging fantasy.
Yeah. And it's the production of this movie is by far one of the most interesting productions we've had. I don't know how much you read up on it and how much of this might be a surprise to you.
It'll probably all be a surprise to me, Adam.
Interesting. Stanley Kubrick, a very an incredibly slow and incredibly hard-working director. So his films take a lot of time to research and prep, and they have a hugely long writing time. And sometimes he'll work on stuff and then just shelve it, either for good or he'll come back to it. He started working on Eyes Wide Shut in 1968.
That's too long.
He was looking for something a bit quicker and a bit looser to film after 2001 A Space Odyssey. And he read the book, Traumnovelle. And this film is based on that. Quite a few things have changed, including updating the setting, because it was set in 1920s Vienna, and now it's 1990s New York. And then he worked on it on and off for a decade. He considered making it a sex comedy starring Steve Martin or Woody Allen. That would have had a very different tone.
Just slightly.
Yeah, then he just left it alone for 20 years. and the work on the version that we have, he started in 1994. Warner Brothers like basically instantly approved the production because it's Stanley Kubrick, but they did ask that he cast a marketable star, which he hadn't done in ages and ages and ages. And initially he was interested in Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger because they were, again, a real-life couple.
Right.
And then Kubrick landed on Cruise and Kidman, who were both in England because Nicole was shooting Portrait of a Lady. Kubrick lived in England. Cruise and Kidman, they went to meet with him and they were just given the roles there and then. And the production was long and arduous. It was very, very difficult. Have you read anything about this?
No, I actually haven't. I have heard that it was a very long production, but then I believe that a lot of Kubrick's films are long productions.
They are. This is by far the longest.
Okay.
Principal photography began in November 1996. So Jerry Maguire wasn't even out at this point. Tom and Nicole had signed on for 6 months, and shooting wrapped in June 1998.
Jesus.
They went home in January 1998 but had to come back for reshoots. So that's over a year and a half. It holds the world record for the longest constant movie shoot, including an unbroken shooting period of 46 weeks. So that's nearly a year of just constant filming with no breaks that were longer than like a day or two.
I bet that did wonders for Tom and Nicole's marriage.
Oh my God, there's probably loads of, you know, there's loads of reasons that they get divorced, but I imagine this was a big yeah. one, you know what I mean?
Do you remember when we pretended to be a couple for almost a year?
I'd like
and we weren't really
now.
A couple. Let it
we
all
can get
end.
Into like, we can get into some of the weirder aspects of the shoot as they come up in the movie, but the Kubrick's like trademarks of like very intense rehearsal, a huge number of takes, only using available light sources that appear on the screen, and that like insane attention to detail. They're all in Eyes Wide Shut. So everything just took forever. One actress was contracted for 2 weeks, but worked for 2 months. Harvey Keitel and Jennifer Jason Leigh were cast in this film. They were not only cast in this film, they shot some of their scenes. Harvey Keitel was going to play Ziegler, that Sydney Pollack plays. Jennifer Jason Leigh was I can't remember who she was going to play. But the production went on so long, they had to bow out and make other movies. So they had to be recast by Sydney Pollack and Maria Richardson. So the scenes that they'd already shot had to be reshot, replaced with new actors.
Jesus.
Cruise and Kidman, they found the shoot very difficult, but the film is mostly Cruise, who must have found it very intense. He is in every single scene. He hated playing the character as well, because he's not a nice guy, but he did that thing that he does, that he just completely immersed himself in the role and in the process. And yeah, like you said at the beginning, like, worshipped Kubrick, and people who worked on the set said they'd never seen an actor give themselves over to a director in the same way that Tom Cruise did for this movie. He just completely trusted Kubrick and did whatever he wanted to do. He completely committed the whole time, even though it was costing him like other roles and therefore money. And also, don't forget, like we talked about for Mission Impossible, he had his new production company, which he just wasn't paying attention to. Tom Cruise said, "I remember talking to Stanley and I said, look, I don't care how long it takes, but I have to know. Are we going to finish in 6 months? People are waiting and writers are waiting." And I said, "Stanley, I don't care. Tell me it's going to be 2 years, but just tell me like something so that I have something to tell other people." But it just went on and on and on. Like, Kubrick's whole thing for like many takes, he knows what he wants from the set and from the cinematography and the colours that he wants to see on screen, but he kind of, a lot of reports say he has no idea what he wants for the characters or from the actors as a performance. And so the large number of takes is just about him breaking down an actor to get past the performance layer of the performance, and then get into something that they have built up themselves until he gets a take where he realizes that that's what he wants. He spent a long time on The Shining doing loads and loads of takes just to wind up Jack Nicholson, so that Jack Nicholson kept having to change what he was doing until he eventually had something much more honest than just an acting performance. And it's all kind of born out of this deliberate conflict that he has with the actors. But Cruise was like so flexible that Kubrick had to like double down.
Well, we saw how flexible he was in Jerry Maguire when he flipped
out. Well, exactly. He made Tom Cruise do 95 takes of walking through a door. Just to like break him. And then Tom Cruise, being a perfectionist, constantly spent all of the time just beating himself up, wanting to basically like constantly please a director who seemed to just never be satisfied. He spent the whole movie unsure that he was doing anything right. He developed an ulcer from the stress, which is exactly what Kubrick wanted, right? Because that's the character in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound a little abusive.
It's very abusive. It's really abusive. But the character is completely lost in the movie, like just behaves as though he's completely lost the whole time, because Cruise genuinely was completely lost. He was not allowed to see dailies, you know, like the practice of going to see what you've shot that day so you can see what you're emoting and transfer it to other scenes. He always saw dailies on all of his films. But he wasn't allowed to. He needed to know where he was in order to figure out where he was going, and he was just told no. And then the line between reality and fiction started to like blur, because in the prep for the movie, they had long like sessions. Nicole and Tom would just sit down with Stanley Kubrick, just the three of them, and Nicole and Tom would talk about their marriage, their fears, their worries, their secrets, things they didn't want the other person to hear, like, which is kind of what they do in the movie, except this time it was before the movie and it was real. The flat that they live in the movie, the characters, Tom and Nicole decorated that and lived in the apartment that it was shot in. The bed they sleep in the movie is the bed they slept in for the whole shoot. And it's their clothes that are strewn around the apartment, not the characters. He gave them separate acting notes that they weren't allowed to share with each other. The fantasy sequence of Nicole Kidman's character having sex with a naval officer, Kubrick insisted that it took 6 days of nude shooting to get right. Tom Cruise wasn't allowed on the set, and Kidman wasn't allowed to talk to him about what happened, to kind of create a jealous atmosphere, a tense atmosphere. It was also the only 6 days that Tom Cruise wasn't allowed on set. Or wasn't needed on set. He was needed on set for every other day. Yeah, he had a 6 day break, constantly worried about what his wife was doing, I guess. Sounds fucking intense. And Tom Cruise never complained. He was in interviews, even after it, he just said, this is Kubrick. He's the master. He was never indulgent. He wanted everything perfect. And, you know, said that he signed on knowing that he wouldn't leave set until the perfect shot had been achieved. And he always just said, no, I loved it. I loved that experience. After all of that fucking insanity had been completed, Kubrick continued into the lengthy and difficult post-production process. It took about another 10 months of like editing and all of that stuff. And then on March the 1st, 1999, so, you know, nearly 3 years, well, it's 2.5 years after starting the shooting, let alone all the prep and stuff. It was like a 4 year total production time. He showed a cut to Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman, and some Warner Brothers executives, and then he died 6 days later. Which means that the final touches to the film, including some looping and like some dialogue scenes and, you know, like looping in dialogue for scenes, and the score were finished without direct input from Stanley Kubrick, but obviously in line with what he was aiming for. However, because of the way he worked and his like perfectionism on previous films, he almost always tinkered with the films basically right up until the premiere. Sometimes he would swap out whole scenes in the week leading up to the premiere of the film, which has led to a lot of discussion over this idea, right? Is this film finished?
I wonder if he would have changed anything had he been alive, given that what you've just said and the fact that this film is not necessarily quite as good as his other films.
Yeah, there are bits of it that to me do feel a little bit unfinished.
Or was he just getting older?
Was he just getting older? That's interesting. And he hadn't worked for 12 years as well. He hadn't made a film for 12 years. There are bits of it that seem unfinished. By all accounts, he would have had... When did you say this came out? In July, the premiere. So he would have had
July
another
US,
3 months of editing on this. And that is a long time. So it's difficult to say. And obviously he had no input on things like the score. And the cut that he delivered on March the 1st is, you know, we don't know if it was the final cut, do we?
No.
Which is interesting. The marketing for the film went all in on the people involved in it. I've seen a trailer that just opens with Cruise, and then it goes Kidman, and then it goes Kubrick, and then that's it. It's great.
What more do you need to know?
Well, exactly. The whole thing was like really secretive. The press kits had no production notes. The trailers revealed nothing about the plot. Had you seen this before, or was this filling a Tom Cruise gap for you?
This was filling a Tom Cruise gap. I have never seen it before. It's one of the Kubrick films that I've already said I'd watch any of them, but it's one of the specific Kubrick films that I would actively go out of my way to see, I think, which is basically everything after probably the 50s.
Yeah.
I was really looking forward to this one.
What did you know about its kind of reputation? Did you have expectations of it going in?
I knew it was, you know, highly sexualized, and that was the kind of the crux of the film was sexual fantasy. But I didn't know the story. I didn't know where the story's direction would go or anything like that. I just knew Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman, real life married couple, sexy story.
Did you know how it had been received when it came out?
No, I think just because it's Kubrick, I assumed that it would have been well received.
Just pure unparalleled genius from start to finish.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. I had seen this before, but in college, which at this point is what?
Too many years ago.
15, nearly 20 years ago. So I remembered so little about it, because I don't even think I gave it an active watch. I remembered like basically nothing about it. You and I did not see the version that came out in cinemas.
No.
We saw the uncut version, which I think is every version that was ever home released after 2007. And has gone through many aspect ratios. We saw it in the aspect ratio that came out in the cinema, but we saw it unedited because in order to guarantee an R rating, the studio digitally altered some of the more sexually explicit scenes during post-production, which included like digital people stood in the way of some of the sex. Just right. Like the shittest way to do that, like at all, like bizarre. But speaking of sex, right, there's a lot of sex in this movie, isn't there?
Did you notice that as well, Adam? Because, yeah, I
noticed
did pick
that
up
this
on
film
that
had a lot of sex. And I also noticed absolutely none of it is in any way sexy.
Oh, it's the least sexy film.
I know, right?
Since Top Gun sex scenes.
This has been, like, talked about, sold as... is regarded as an erotic thriller. Would you agree with that?
I agree that that's probably the genre it should be put in, but it's not sexy.
It's not erotic, is it?
And it's nowhere near as like explicit as you, the viewer, the audience is led to expect it to be.
Right. Yes, that's true. Yeah, it actually all
like
seemed...
A Clockwork Orange is way more explicit in content than this.
It is. But also, this was 23 years ago now. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we see more explicit things in films that are rated 15, like these days.
Yeah. I mean, films like Species existed, for example.
That's true.
And they're shit, yes. But they are still widely available. Everyone knows about it.
Yeah, that's true. Mind you, the plot of that is like what is the plot of Species? She has to have sex with a lot of people, right?
It's an alien lands on Earth and needs to procreate.
I'll rent that tonight. That sounds good. But yeah, it's not very right. It has sex. It has nudity. It is immersed in the world of sex. But the sex itself is so unsexy. But all of the build-up to the sex scenes, or like the air of flirtatiousness that it sometimes has, that is kind of sexy. And then all of the sex is really matter-of-fact, except for like some fantasy scenes. And
I guess it's all about the tension and the expectation, i.e. a fantasy. Exactly.
Which actually, now I don't know if you've had sex before, Tom, but in my opinion,
I wouldn't want to mention it on the podcast. Okay.
I think that's part of the genius of the movie, is that it understands that the best bit about sex is all the stuff before you have sex. And this, like, you know, the flirtatiousness of it, and, you know, the expectation of it is always, you know, usually better than a lot of the reality. And this is a movie about a guy who's, like, chasing sex. Tom Cruise, so horny in this movie.
Yeah, he is literally quaking with desire.
The movie is just about being, like, so horny. And then all the sex is, like, seedy and kind of grim. And there's all this, like... Did you find there to be, like, a streak of kind of darkness running through the movie?
Oh, yeah. No, I thought that there was going to be some real, like... I mean, I guess there is, but, like, a real, like, conspiracy or something violent. And I mean, we'll discuss all that, obviously, as we go through the actual story, because to some degree there is, or could be. But I really thought it was going to be like, you know, finding dead people in a bed and being like, oh, my God. But it's quite grounded, despite the expectation of there being this major thing, which, again, could be seen as reflecting the build up. And temptation and desire of sex, but not actually
exactly.
The payoff.
Well, that's the kind of thing, like the whole payoff of the movie kind of mirrors that as well, is that he's putting together all of these like threads of conspiracy and, you know, all this darkness and all these things that happen in secret and stuff. And you get to the end of the movie and the answer may actually turn out to be, no, you made that all up. Like, everything's actually fine.
Yeah.
Like, the payoff is, like, disappointing after all of this incredible build-up, in the same way that kind of a lot of the sex scenes are, and in the same way that that I think something else about the movie is, which I'll get onto later. The film also seems to be about dreams, and a lot of the movie feels like it takes place in a dream.
Oh, I agree, 100%. I mean, we'll discuss it later, but there's moments whenever they're, like, having a... Cruise and Nicole's characters having a like a deep conversation where they're revealing things about their fantasies or things like that, and the light outside, because it's night, is bright luminous blue.
Yeah exactly,
like it's so fantastical and bizarre and surreal.
And the entire like inciting incident of this movie is a fantasy that Kidman's character had. And there's loads of dream logic in the movie, and moments where the story refers back to itself in that way that dreams do, or the way that, like, when you, like, see something and it suddenly jogs your memory of what you dreamt about the night before. There's loads of stuff that feels like that, like characters mentioning, like, rainbows, or, like, he'll get into a situation because of a coincidence rather than because he meant to do it. And it's also set at Christmas.
Yes. Don't know what you want me to add to that.
Well, it initially seems like a throwaway whatever kind of thing. But the more I thought about it, the more perfect it is. I think, Tom, this is the ultimate Christmas movie.
Yeah?
Fuck It's a Wonderful Life. I don't care about the Santa Claus or any of that. Eyes Wide Shut. Perfect Christmas movie.
You want to sit around on Christmas Day with the kids? Watch Eyes Wide Shut.
I think the way that it uses Christmas and the way that Christmas is, you know, there's all those people that that say like, oh, it can't be a Christmas film unless Christmas is an integral part of the plot, right? It's so wrapped up in all the themes of Eyes Wide Shut. We'll get onto it as we go through it. But let's talk about Cruise. How do you feel about his performance?
It's good. It's. I mean, we're delving into Cruise-ness
in, sure.
like, realm here, but like, it's good. It's not a Tom Cruise performance in the way that we might expect.
It's very. It's what I would call flat.
Yes, but flat in a good way for the film. Like repressed.
Yeah, exactly. He's like weirdly blank, which I think is perfect for the film. There's a film critic, Amy Nicholson. I was reading some of her writing about Eyes Wide Shut, and she talks about how the film kind of wants Cruise not to project his feelings onto the audience, but for the audience to make up their own mind on the morals of the story. So Cruise just needs to be like a blank slate for us to impart our feelings onto. She makes the interesting point that it's as though he's wearing a mask through the whole thing, not just in like the ritual orgy scene. Spoilers if you've not seen Eyes Wide Shut. But it's weird that like Kubrick cast Tom Cruise and then used none of his like charisma, didn't use any of his charm. And even with the film like that has like a dark streak, it didn't even use like the dark side of Tom Cruise. He's just like a flat personality vacuum, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you think that that was a, well, obviously it's Kubrick, so it was a deliberate choice. But do you think it was a deliberate choice in almost like the audience's expectation of what you would receive from a Cruise performance and then having that subjected, possibly disappointed in that regard?
Yeah, I think he's trying to like subvert something, right?
Yeah.
Like the outward Cruise is probably the same as the outward Bill, you know, very outgoing. We see a little bit of it at the beginning. They're very charming, kind of schmoozy. But for a lot of the film, we're with just Bill in situations that he's uncomfortable with. And he does become very repressed and stuff. And in terms of like, is it Cruise's choice or Kubrick's choice? There's another thing that Amy Nicholson writes about, which is like, he had him do 95 takes of walking through a door, right? So Tom Cruise gave him 95 performances, and the take he used was Kubrick's choice.
Right.
So that has to be the one that he wanted. That has to be the one where he was like, no, that's perfect. So for everything that he's done hundreds of takes of or whatever, Kubrick's selecting maybe the flattest Tom Cruise performance, I guess. But there's also all this metatextual stuff as to why you would use Tom Cruise, which is obviously his marriage. I think there's stuff in there about the questionable sexuality, which was hanging around Tom Cruise. There's a lot of, like, there's some gay coding in Eyes Wide Shut, which is very interesting when it's applied to the fact that it's Tom Cruise in that role, you know?
Yeah.
We should get into the film. What I would say, before we get into the movie properly, what I would say is, like, anybody here listening to this for the definitive take on Eyes Wide Shut, you're probably in like the wrong place. There is like, there's so much symbolism and subtext and hidden meaning and parallel narratives, like that intertwine with all the meta narratives that we cannot even begin to untangle. Tom, you watched it once. I watched it once 15 years ago and twice in the past week or so. And I don't think that that is anywhere near enough to get through all of the things that I think Kubrick is doing here. And nor do I fully understand them. It's like a mad puzzle. So this is just sort of our take on it. We're not going to like finally decode Eyes Wide Shut for people. Okay, great. The opening shot is of Nicole Kidman getting undressed.
Yep. Sets the tone, already, doesn't it?
Already
fully,
I'm in.
Fully nude from behind. Just like, there you go. That's what the film is.
Yep. And then the opening bit of narrative filmmaking is like a long shot of Bill Harford, played by Tom Cruise, and his wife Alice, which is Nicole Kidman, getting ready to go out. It more or less cuts from this incredibly beautiful woman undressing to her sitting on the toilet which is a great juxtaposition, completely undercutting the sexiness of anything. They do it in the first 20 seconds of the movie. They're disgustingly rich, aren't they?
Yeah, their apartment is ludicrously nice. Ludicrous.
And it's in the centre of New York as well. It's in Manhattan. Bill is a doctor. We're introduced to their daughter. And the thing they're getting ready to go to is a party. It's a big Christmas party hosted by one of Bill Harford's wealthy patients, Victor Ziegler, played by Sidney Pollack. The party is incredibly sparkly. It's lit entirely by those draped fairy lights. Looks incredible. Tom Cruise is kind of charming in this section, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, he ends up chatting to two very attractive young models. So he must be fairly charming, because otherwise they would not be chatting to him.
He does the big smile. He's reunited with Nick Nightingale, isn't he? Who is an old medical school classmate who dropped out, didn't become a doctor, and now plays the piano professionally. So he's playing piano at that party, and they catch up. And that is kind of the only time that you see the charismatic Cruise. But it's the intense, slightly fake chat show version of friendly Tom Cruise. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's slightly too much. And then Nick Nightingale is called away, but mentions that he's playing for the next 2 weeks at the Sonata Cafe. And while that's going on, Alice is being seduced by this older Hungarian guest, the actor of whom is really blurring the line between charming and creepy, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's charming in the sense that he's clearly charismatic, but I'd say he's also fully, the needle has fully gone on to creepy.
Yeah, he's quite forceful about his advances. There's something quite predatory about him.
He's just insinuating that Kidman should cheat on Cruise.
Yeah, but then also weirdly, because they're dancing, Alice kind of seems a little bit into it, or is very drunk, but does eventually refuse to go somewhere else with him. Which I don't know if Bill would have done, because he's talking to those two young models who are seducing Bill, and they ask him if he'd like to go where the rainbow ends. But he's interrupted. So we see Alice straight out turn down the advances of someone. We don't, you know, Bill is just interrupted. He's not quite as forceful about the refusal, right?
He does show some reluctance. In his language, he's still being led along, but he's kind of just like, where are we going? Are we sure? What's going on here?
I reckon they could lead him all the way to a bed, mate.
Oh, really, I'm sure. I'm sure they could. But he's at least at the point where we see him, at least trying to put up a defense, even if that defense is a wet paper towel.
The thing he's interrupted by is like one of Ziegler's manservants coming down to fetch him, because Ziegler has been having sex with Mandy, a young woman who has overdosed on a speedball, which I think is heroin and cocaine, right?
Yes, I believe so. Not really the expert on drugs, but
really? Okay, fair enough. I thought you would have been like, oh no, I know exactly what that is and what ratio you take them in and best way to take them.
And I'm on it now.
That's why I thought you'd be be the best person to ask.
But I'm also unconscious and naked in a bathroom.
Yes. Yeah. Again, as you are for every episode.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we go straight from like, I know the Hungarian guy is creepy, but there's an electricity between him and Alice, and there is between Bill and the two models, and we go straight from this kind of electrifying, flirtatious stuff straight into the dark reality of the sex that's actually being had rather than promised. Because he basically has to treat this young woman who is completely unconscious. And Cruise is like, I have no idea what he's thinking in this scene at all. He's just completely neutral. He may well think it's an awful situation or be excited by it, but he's in front of his patient. So I don't know. Maybe he's wearing that professional mask. Yeah, masks, Tom. Yeah, I think
at least what I thought when I was watching it, that he was just being a professional doctor. So the context of the situation is somewhat irrelevant at that point, as it would be in a hospital, for example. You're not going to be like, oh, excuse me, I think what happened here was illegal, and so I need to get to the bottom of this before I save your life.
It's just weird that he doesn't even, like, he's not giving anything. There's no second guessing in his eyes or anything. He's just completely neutral, even when Ziegler then asks him to keep it a secret, because as we've learned from when they're introduced, that young woman, not Ziegler's wife.
Oh, risque.
Dear. I know. Mandy does recover, though. Bill helps her and kind of says, you know, you need to stop doing this, because if you keep doing this, you're going to die. Alice says to the Hungarian guest that she's married, and then we cut to the beginning of a sex scene between Bill and Alice, which fades down before they actually engage in any sex. And it's quite a sexy shot, the one in the mirror.
Yeah.
And then it fades down before it stops being sexy, basically, I think is what happens there.
Yeah. Also, and this may again be a deliberate choice by Kubrick for the audience, etc., but we see a lot of naked kidmen and no naked crews.
Yeah, I was gutted. Really gutted about that.
Not even a bum.
Not even a bum. There's a bit later where someone says, take all your clothes off, to Tom Cruise, and I thought, oh, here we go, finally. But no. Yeah. Unbelievable. Rescued by a naked woman. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I think that is a choice to kind of for the film to objectify women in the same way that all of the male characters in the film objectify women.
Yes.
That may be a charitable read of it, and the film is just objectifying women. But I do think it's in keeping with the tone of the film. And then we get a montage of like Bill at work, Alice getting their daughter out of bed and going about the day with her, and it's all under classical music. Tom Cruise wearing jeans and Ugg boots is an absolute vibe, and I really hope that's part of just his casual attire. I hope that's something he brought to set.
Yeah. Kubrick just looked at it and went, off of, you know what, fine,
let's go with it, whatever. Tom was just like, look, if I'm going to be here for a year and a half, I might as well be comfortable. That evening they smoke a joint, and Alice and Bill discuss their episodes of unfulfilled temptation. And it's an interesting scene, actually, because Bill tells Alice that he's not jealous of like other men being attracted to her, because he kind of thinks that women are naturally inclined to fidelity. And then Alice discloses that during their vacation to Cape Cod, she encountered a naval officer and then fantasized about him enough that she considered leaving Bill and their daughter. It's a very intense scene.
It's a ludicrous thing to spring on someone, even if you're pissed with them.
Well, yeah, but I think she's high, right?
Like, yeah.
I think that's the other
thing. She's high, but that's still ludicrous. Like, imagine just dropping that bombshell and just thinking, oh, I'll be fine in the morning.
I mean, the film is about, like, what it's like to be, well, what Stanley Kubrick thinks it's like to be married, I suppose, and keeping secrets from each other. Nicole's really good in the scene, and Tom is doing the Kubrick stare. You must know what the Kubrick stare is.
Oh, yeah. It's just, it's the brow down,
eyes up.
Yeah.
Great. Really interesting scene. The discussion feels like it comes from a real place. The discussion about, like, does Tom Cruise's character not cheat because he wants to cheat but just doesn't because he's married, or because he's genuinely faithful and has no sexual feelings towards any other woman? Like, I feel like iterations of that come up amongst real couples all the time.
Oh, yeah. And it is a ludicrous idea because, like, obviously, speaking from personal experience, when you become married,
here
you don't...
Here we go. Excellent.
Here we go. Right.
Really making sure I record this and send this to your wife. Okay, here we go.
We've had this discussion. When you get married, you don't suddenly stop being sexually attracted to other people. You just respect the other person enough to not have sex with other people.
Yeah, and that
seems straightforward.
To not be enough for Alice. But also, Bill kind of assumes that women don't feel that way, and that only men feel that way, right?
Yeah. Like, he thinks that they just switch it off once they get married or something.
It's, yeah, which is ludicrous. Strange. And the whole monologue... The monologue is very good when she's talking about how actually women actually enjoy having sex, and they actually want to have sex. Like, they have a sexual desire as well. And that seems to be a big surprise to Bill. Yeah. And the argument portion actually feels like a real argument, and it feels quite emotionally honest. It's a very interesting scene, and is the catalyst for the entire movie, because Bill is like disturbed by this recounting of her sexual fantasies about the naval officer, but he's like, this whole argument is again interrupted in the same way as in the previous scene, because he's being called to the house of a patient who has just died. And on the taxi ride there, he's thinking about his wife having sex with the naval officer. And this is the fantasy scenes that are interspersed throughout the whole movie that took 6 days of nude shooting for Nicole Kidman to get right, apparently. The taxi ride also has rear projection. It's not a real taxi. It's projected in the same way that Hitchcock used to do. And I think it's not supposed to look real. It is supposed to look slightly disconnected and slightly dreamlike. Now that we're in the world of fantasy and dreams, there's a lot of rear projection used in scenes, not always in cars as well.
When you say rear projection,
yeah,
what do you mean?
So, like, to make a car look like it's moving, there'll be a screen behind the car, and they project like streets onto it moving past the car.
Okay, got you. I was wondering whether it was like a lighting technique or something.
Kind of is. You need light to play through the film, you know? So everything, at the end of the day, all of film is a lighting technique, Tom.
It is, isn't it?
Writing, it's also that down, audio. Title of my book. All of film is a lighting technique.
Asterix, except for the audio.
Except for the audio.
Which can sometimes make or break a film. I do have a random Jenny note here, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I watched this with Jenny.
Can we get these for every film? That would be delightful.
We have occasionally with like a few good men. Right.
Yeah.
Got some legal opinions on that.
Sure.
But she pointed out that some of this dialogue, especially when they're having the argument, etc., feels like a play. Which is 100% true. And again, I wonder if that is, considering that that's not really the case, I think, with other Kubrick films in particular. Again, I wonder if that's like a case of that kind of heightened fantastical reality of everything in this film, and the expectation that never lives up to reality, etc.
Definitely. I think that's spot on. When he gets to the house of the patient who has died, he talks to Marion, which is kind of the patient's distraught daughter, who unsuccessfully tries to seduce Bill in a scene that I was left very confused by.
Yeah.
I was not sure if they had been, on first watch, if they had been having a previous affair, or if she's just become a little bit unhinged, you know?
I think the idea is that they know each other because he's been looking after her dad as a physician.
Yeah.
And then she's just had a bit of a breakdown because she's grown attached to him because of his... No.
She kisses him and then says things like, even if I never see you again, I just want to know that I live near you. Which is very alarming, isn't it?
It's fine. It's absolutely fine. You see, I feel like this scene, cut it out.
No, that feels dreamlike. It's like a horrible, weird dream, and nothing makes sense. And it comes right after the first fantasy exploration thing.
But it also kind of feels like it exists solely to bridge, like to give Tom Cruise a reason to be out on the streets, where you could have just had him march out of the house.
You could have done, but I like this scene. I think this is good. It makes me feel very... If he just, like, left because he was angry with Alice and was like, right, well, now I'm going to cheat on you, that feels very cut and dry.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas the whole thing of like, okay, now I'm confused about his relationship with other people. I'm confused about his relationship with this woman in particular. And now the fact that he is out when he wasn't intending to be out, and the fact that this could have been an argument that was actually just resolved in half an hour, but has been like left unresolved, leading him to make these very odd, potentially out of character decisions. I think that's absolutely necessary for the film. I think it needs to set you off on like a weird, you feel off kilter about it. Do you know what I mean?
And you're probably right, but I still felt just kind of...
You're probably right, but I don't care.
I don't care. It didn't need to be in there.
It's absolutely necessary.
Fine. Maybe a scene of that nature should have been, but I felt it was a little... It felt tacked on. Perhaps it should have been improved. It's definitely weird. Kubrick could have done a better job.
We meet Billy Zane, obviously.
Well, obviously we meet Billy Zane, and that's probably the only reason for the scene.
Yeah, because we've got Billy Zane. He then leaves, and he's just walking around the streets of New York. He sees a couple groping each other, which makes him again think of his wife and the naval officer. And the dreamlike stuff that we saw in the very necessary previous scene continues in like a couple of ways. There is one shot where Cruise is walking in New York, but it's rear projection. It's these days it would be done by green screen and would probably look quite realistic, but it deliberately looks weird and disconnected because Tom Cruise, the actor, is, you know, mirroring the thing where Tom Cruise's character feels disconnected by literally not being in a real place. He's walking on a treadmill with a projection of the New York City put up behind him. And also, all of the streets that you see Tom Cruise walk on are a set.
Right.
There is no...
Because they do look amazing.
Yeah, like, I learned it afterwards. I was like, oh, it's, you know, how did Kubrick manage to shut down whole New York blocks for as many takes as he wanted? It was shot in London. It was shot in Pinewood Studios.
Of course, yeah, because he doesn't leave the UK.
Yeah, he's scared of flying. He can't leave the UK. Whole movie's shot in Pinewood Studios, which means there isn't a single, apart from like some footage that doesn't have Tom Cruise in for like establishing shots, New York isn't in this movie. It's either rear projection of previously filmed New York, or it's a set that they built of a few blocks of New York. Which is incredible.
Mad.
It looks absolutely insane, but also it looks completely real. But now that I know it's not real, that adds another layer to the realness, fakeness of the movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Very interesting. He also gets knocked down by a group of people who attack him for being gay. They call him a homophobic slur. In the novel, that group attacks that character for being Jewish. So it's interesting that Kubrick seems to have changed it specifically for Tom Cruise because there were lots of questions about his sexuality and there's more meta-narrative stuff going on there.
I got shouted at for being Jewish once. And as you know, Adam, I'm not Jewish.
Famously not Jewish. Yeah.
Yeah.
How weird. Strange. Where did that happen?
It's a crazy person. I was on my way to a restaurant with Jenny on like Valentine's Day years back, and some random mentalist, and not in the Darren Brown way. Darren Brown didn't say it.
You mean the TV show, The Mentalist?
Yeah, yeah. Right. No, some odd person, shall we say? You know, probably homeless. I'd seen them around a few times. Just shouted something vaguely insulting. It wasn't even like a slur. He just shouted something Jew at me.
Wow.
It was
fascinating.
Weird.
Fascinating.
Shepherd's Bush can be a weird place sometimes.
Yeah, Shepherd's Bush. It's the Weird. That's really weird. I don't know what to tell you, Tom. Yeah, that's really weird. To be attacked for being Jewish when you're not Jewish is bizarre. Yeah. While Bill is walking the streets, well, or the not streets of New York, he engages with a sex worker named Domino, who stops him in the street and invites him in. That's a weird bit of coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah, that's another random coincidence slash almost contrived.
Yeah, because it's a dream. And so the things that he wants while he's dreaming just appear in front of him. You know, already like women are just like throwing themselves at his feet. So
I kind of feel like, to add to that, like there's no way that scenario would have played out in that way. If a random woman came up to you at the side of a street while you're about to cross it and, you know, suggests you going back to her apartment despite you not approaching her and... Yeah. There being no reason for you two to talk, she's going to steal your watch.
That's so like, rude, Tom. She's not. Why can't you just make some honest money having sex with him? Why does she need to steal the watch?
I just feel like, well, no,
More enlightened times than that.
I feel like she's just going to steal the watch or a wallet or something. I feel like it's some sort of scam.
Well, she turns out to be very nice, and they get on really well. And again, they are flirting, but you know. Bill's very awkward. He doesn't really know how to do this. And they talk about money. They start negotiating. And she asks him, like, what do you want? And he's like, what do you recommend? Which is a very funny thing to say to a sex worker. What do you recommend? What's your favourite thing on the menu?
Yeah.
Look, sex equals Christmas. Okay, you know, sex is a negotiation, also sex is modern day Christmas, there's no emotion, it's mostly about money. Christmas, perfect time to set this film. And they start kissing, and then Alice phones to find out when Bill is coming home, and he kind of has a change of heart, right? He's like brought back to reality by that phone call. But he does pay Domino for the sexless encounter. Domino is played by Vanessa Shaw. She doesn't appear in the movie again. She is in the film for probably, 3 to 4 minutes in that one scene? Yeah. 2 months.
Jesus.
It took them 2 months to get that scene.
So is she the 2 week to 2 months?
Yeah, supposed to be 2 weeks, and it took 2 months. And then Tom Cruise is again... horny on the streets of New York. That's what this movie should have been called. And another coincidence, while he's walking, he just happens to be in front of the jazz club that Nick is playing at. The pianist that he met earlier in the night, he finds himself suddenly outside the Sonata Cafe. Having not intended to go there, he finds himself, oh, that's the Sonata Cafe. So he goes in just as it ends, and Nick has a drink with him. Again, maybe... if he'd been half an hour earlier, he'd have had a drink, watched some of the set, and then left and not had a conversation with Nick. But he's there right at the end of the set, exactly when he needs to be there in order for Nick to have a drink with him and describe a job that he has that night where he has to play blindfolded in the middle of these events that feature beautiful women. And he says that people who are invited... have to have a costume, a mask, and a password. This whole scene looks like amazing. It's all lit by Christmas lights. The whole movie is lit by Christmas lights, basically. And it feels like otherworldly. There's loads of stuff about Christmas. Not only is everything lit by Christmas lights, there isn't a single room that has a scene take place in it that doesn't have a Christmas tree. Don't know if you noticed that.
I did not, but now you've mentioned it, that is very true.
Constantly mentioning trees, that's a nice tree. You can always see a Christmas tree in the background of stuff, except for at the big house that they end up at. He shows the password, and then Bill kind of insists for the address of this party. He's like, hey, if there's beautiful women there, I've got to be there. That's the vibe of the night. He does get the address, and then he goes to a costume shop because he has to get, you know, the kind of the costume for the party. It's called Rainbow Fashions. The actual shop is called Under the Rainbow. Symbolism, like the dreamlike symbol, the coincidence of the girls at the beginning of the film saying, do you want to go to where the rainbow ends? you know, those kind of references to whatever is at the end of the rainbow, be it a pot of gold or your dreams being fulfilled, or just as it is for Bill in this movie, having sex with someone, you know, like that it's something else that is mentioned earlier and comes back and is part of the dream logic of this movie. And he offers the new owner, who is insane, Milich, a generous amount of money to rent a costume. Again, all problems in this movie solved with money. I think that there is some stuff you can read into there about consumerism and capitalism, how, you know, everything is for sale, as we will see with this specific character in a couple of scenes time, but also any problem can be solved with money, especially around Christmas. He asks for a tuxedo, cloak with a hood and a mask, and I've got written down, isn't this what you go to work in?
Me?
Yeah. A tuxedo, a cloak with a hood, and a mask.
Yeah.
You look like a plague doctor.
Yeah. I mean, I do generally walk around. See, it's funny you say that, Adam, but I just went to Venice, and there are multiple shops everywhere where they just have those masks and cloaks outside.
Yeah, absolutely, because this is... that's a famous, like, European thing, is masked balls, right?
Yeah.
And so all of the masks in this movie are Venetian masks. Yeah, that's one of the famous things about Venice. How was Venice? Was it lovely?
It's lovely, yeah. Lots and lots of pasta. And you know what I like, Adam? Pasta.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah.
Love a spaghetti bolognese.
When he said spaghetti bolognese. When he is getting this cloak and hood and mask, Milich catches his very young daughter in some kind of sexual engagement with two much older men. And it's a very strange, chaotic scene. The darkness of those two men being caught with his daughter, who is very young, and she whispers something in Bill's ear as she leaves, no doubt offering sex in some kind of way. It's just all of that little dark stuff that's going on. This film makes me feel very uncomfortable in lots of scenes, you know.
Well, like we said earlier, it's not a sexy film.
No. It's about, like, sex, but it's not sexy. Yeah.
It just makes you uncomfortable about different things, whether it's like a clearly underage teenage girl sleeping with older men, or if it's regular sex but done in such an unromantic fashion.
Yeah, the denouement of her, like, storyline as well is particularly grim. Bill takes a taxi to the country mansion that was mentioned by Nick. Again, he's on the journey there, he's just staring into space with images of his wife. He offers the taxi extraordinary money to wait for him. Again, another problem that's just solved by money. And he gives the password, which is Fidelio, which is an opera by Beethoven, but also awfully close to the word fidelity, which is pretty ironic. I think they have the same Latin base word. And in there, he discovers that a very strange, cult-like sexual ritual is taking place. It's insanely creepy.
It's full-on horror. It's Shining level horror all over again.
The music is dark and it features kind of like monastic Gregorian chanting. There's a guy, he's obviously the main guy, in a red cloak with a staff and an incense burner. Naked women pair off with men to different rooms, and everyone is in those Venetian masks, including Tom Cruise, who, very interesting, little odd little tidbit, obsessed with masks at this point in his career. Mission Impossible.
Oh, yeah.
Eyes Wide Shut, Mission Impossible 2, and Vanilla Sky are all about masks. Weird. Yeah. Weird. There's that one masked person who is staring at Bill, and then when Bill looks over, they just nod at him. Very creepy.
Yeah.
Very slow and tense, because, you know, Bill shouldn't be there. He has snuck in. And eventually,
the whole point
is
that everyone is anonymous, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So why would someone nod specifically at him?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, it's all really creepy. A woman approaches Bill and then takes him away and tells him that he doesn't belong there. He's in grave danger. And then that woman is taken away by someone else, leaving Bill to kind of go through all these rooms, witnessing all the sex that is now taking place. And to me, didn't feel exciting in any way, the sex scenes No. in this. It felt dark and odd. And Bill is, again, masked, anonymous, disconnected from the reality of things that are actually happening. And he's walking through it like a dream. Those shots are so dreamlike, where Kubrick's using the Steadicam to like drift through these rooms full of people having some of the worst sex I've ever seen in my life, is what it looks like.
Yeah, it's neither erotic or even, I would even say, taboo. And I think the latter is probably was meant to be more taboo, I suspect.
Yeah, but with the proliferation of free porn on the internet, it's pretty tame, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just like, oh, look, there's some people having sex.
Oh, they're having sex. Yeah. The woman then finds him again, catches up with him again, and basically begs him to leave, saying that she can't leave. She can't go with him because it could cost her life. Incidentally, Tom, that's Kate Blanchett's voice. And I know that character's not played by Kate Blanchett, but the actress couldn't do a convincing American accent. So they dubbed her with Kate Blanchett.
That's cool.
As suggested by Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman post Stanley Kubrick's death. So Stanley Kubrick worked with Kate Blanchett and he wasn't even aware of it. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I bet he'd be livid.
Livid about it. He hates Kate Blanchett. Bill is summoned to the main room in front of a large group and red cloak, and they've basically sussed him, haven't they?
Yeah.
It looks like he's in serious trouble. I got the impression that he was in life-threatening trouble. Did you get that?
Yeah. Impression? I thought that was the direction everything was going. I thought the sex was going to just basically be like, oh, look how weird this is. There's lots of weird sex. And then it was actually going to be like, that's not really what this film's about. People are about to get murdered in front of your eyes. Like,
Yeah, there's a lot of tension in that scene. And they ask him to undress. It seems like it's going to go that way. And then the masked woman who's been looking after Bill offers herself up to redeem him.
After a fantastic sudden zoom. Oh,
incredible. Stop. crash zoom. Great. She offers to redeem him at an undisclosed personal cost. She's taken away by somebody else, a plague doctor, in fact. I clocked who that was by now, or who that was meant to be in the narrative. Had you clocked that?
No, I don't think I have.
Interesting. Who was it? Well, oh, wait, so you still don't know?
No.
Because it is spelled out later in the movie.
I've probably missed it. Is it what's his face? The guy who...
I mean the woman.
Oh, right, no, the woman, yes. Sorry, yes, I thought you meant the guy in the plague doctor mask who came
up.
No. I don't remember there being a reveal of the plague doctor.
Unimportant.
Right, Mandy, obviously, yes.
Yes, but had you cottoned onto that so far? Because it feels like the film wants it to be a secret so far.
Yeah, I didn't find it to be a secret. As soon as somebody came over and started talking, I was like, I feel like the only reason she can suspect that this is Tom Cruise is because she's met him. And it's not Nicole Kidman, because we've seen her naked, and it's not the same person.
it's obviously there's a thing of kind of like a life for a life. So he kind of saved Mandy's life by treating her. And it feels that big in the moment. It feels like she's going to have her life taken away from her. But Bill is let off with a warning not to tell anybody about what happened. And he goes back home and he hides the costume. And he finds Alice laughing in her sleep and wakes her up. And she then starts to cry and explains a dream in which she was having sex with the naval officer and then many other men. And they were laughing at the idea of Bill witnessing her having sex with so many other men. And it's interesting that her dream mirrors kind of Bill's actual experience that night. And I think that kind of freaks Bill out And the next morning, he goes looking for Nick at the jazz club, and then a diner, and then finally his hotel. And the desk clerk explains that a bruised and frightened Nick checked out hours earlier, like at like 5 a.m. in the morning or something, escorted by two dangerous-looking men, which is obviously worrying, because it implies that they have found out that, you know, that Bill got the address from him. Bill returns the costume but has lost the mask. So, again, solved by money. He just says, I'll pay for it.
Adam, before we go any further, who was the desk clerk?
Alan Cumming.
It's only Alan Cumming.
It's a treat, isn't it, to see Alan Cumming? Yeah, he turns up in a bunch of stuff. And I can't remember what I even know him from, really. He's just GoldenEye. In loads of stuff, right? What?
GoldenEye.
Oh, of course he is. Yes, he's invincible, isn't he?
He's
yes.
invincible.
Of course. Of course. While he is paying for the mask, Milich's daughter comes into the costume shop, again, sort of scantily clad. And then the two older men from the night before follow her out. And basically, he clocks that Milich has sold his teenage daughter into sex slavery.
Yeah.
And offers her to Bill. Says, you know, if you ever need anything else, do let me know. Grim. Really
yeah,
grim.
Bit. Yeah. Grim.
Really grim. He continues to have thoughts of his wife sleeping with the naval officer, and so he leaves his office early to return to the site of the orgy. I think he's kind of investigating, right? This reminded me a bit of The Firm, because it feels like we're in like thriller-esque yeah. territory of him like investigating a conspiracy of some kind. And he stands at the front gate, and a man comes down to greet him and hands him an envelope addressed to him by name, and inside is an anonymous letter issuing him a second warning to stay away. So he returns home, and this scene is a really nice little breather for about 30 seconds when he's like, hey gang, how are you? And he's talking to his daughter. But then as he opens a beer or whatever, he starts staring at Alice and remembering the fantasies that she told him about and the dream that she had. So he goes back to work and he's having more thoughts, and he thinks, you know, I think at this point he's thinking, do you know what? Okay, I'm going to try again. Second night in a row. Let's really try and cheat on my wife this time. Is that basically what he's thinking?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's just getting... He's conflating real life and fantasy. Like, the two are becoming, as we've seen with the film, they're becoming very much like...
blurred.
They're very, very blurred. So he's kind of now being like, as if she's cheated on him. Now he needs to equal that. By cheating on her.
Yeah.
Except it hasn't happened.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, one hasn't happened. So Bill calls Marion, the daughter of the dead patient. That's his first instinct, is he wants to see if she's available, I suppose. Which is why that earlier scene's so important, Tom. Okay. But of course, Billy Zane answers, and then he hangs up. So instead...
Actually, Billy Zane answered.
Well, exactly. You don't want to get beaten up by Billy Zane. So instead, Bill heads to Domino's apartment, looking to actually have sex with her this time, but is greeted by a woman who, look, I started to become very suspicious of everyone, claims that she is Domino's roommate, Sally, although I think it's probably a house that whoever is working that night uses. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
See what I'm euphemistically describing?
It doesn't seem big enough for... multiple people to live there.
Exactly. There's only one bed, you know. Well, I don't want to make assumptions about their lifestyle, but anyway, it seems like they're gonna have sex instead, because there's a vibe, and like he starts kind of maybe undressing her, but because, you know, like Sally knew about Bill because Domino had told her that he was really nice to her, basically, in a way that maybe other customers aren't. So she feels it necessary to then reveal to Bill that Domino had received just that morning the results of a test that indicated she was HIV positive. Now, I don't know how I feel about that scene in the context of modern times. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think anything to do with HIV doesn't necessarily age well, just because of the fears that everyone has in each different like era.
Yeah, yeah. This is a really good example of a clumsy way of using HIV as a punishment, because we're supposed to think that like, oh, Bill, you've had a lucky escape there by not having sex with that sex worker who had HIV. Bloody hell! And I don't really like that. You know. I don't know. It's quite effective in the film, but it just it took me out of the film a little bit.
I mean,
not really a fault of the film.
No, I agree with you. But then, like you said, it is effective because it suddenly like brings to home like a reality. Like we've had so much dream work and dream work? Yeah, DreamWorks Studios. We've had so much
DreamWorks,
like dream-like stuff going on. And like suddenly to have like, oh, actually this can happen if you just pay for sex.
Yeah,
if you just have unprotected sex with someone, you can actually, you know, have a life altering at the time, possibly even life ending.
Completely destroys the fantasy element of the sex he wants to have, right?
Yeah.
So he just leaves the apartment again. This guy is forever just feeling horny and walking the streets of New York. But this time, he notices that he's being followed by someone, a mysterious figure, and he buys a paper so that he's near someone and he can check when he's being followed, and then he ducks into a cafe, and then in the paper, he sees the news of a beauty queen who's been hospitalized from an overdose. And I think he's putting two and two together and making five, but upon further reflection, the five does actually look a lot like a four. Do you know what I mean by that? Like, I don't know how he gets there, but he does kind of end up being right, because he assumes that it's the woman from the previous night who redeemed Bill, and he goes to the hospital to visit her, only to find out that she has died. And then he goes to the morgue and identifies her as Mandy from the party at the beginning of the film. I think everyone is probably ahead of the film there. I don't think anybody is confused about what's going on, and probably has it before his character gets to the morgue.
I think the name Mandy, no, the name Amanda, I think it does appear in the article.
Yeah, exactly.
So it really is like the easiest riddle to solve.
Yeah.
As an audience member.
And then the morgue scene is very odd, where you think he's going to kiss the corpse of...
Yeah.
The dead sex worker, and you know, despite having no connection with her aside from this weird thing that happened the night before, I mean, it's you know, the tone of this movie is deeply, makes me deeply uncomfortable. Not
it's
as uncomfortable as Crash,
not
as uncomfortable as Crash, which we've talked about a number of times. And he is then summoned again by Ziegler, and when he gets to Ziegler's house, Ziegler reveals that he was at the orgy and knew that Bill was there, and subsequently worked out the connection with Nick. And Ziegler claims that the secret society's warnings are only intended to scare Bill from speaking about the orgy. He does kind of imply that the society is capable of acting on its threats, but also says that it hasn't. I love the bit where he reveals how rubbish Tom Cruise's character was at the deception. Like, the reason they catch him out is because they ask him for a second password, which he doesn't know. But it turns out that there wasn't even a second password. He turned up in a taxi rather than a limousine. And
bit
when he checked in his coat, he left the receipt with his name on it in the pocket. Rubbish. Absolutely shit. Bill asks about Nick's disappearance and Mandy's death, correctly identifying her as the masked orgy participant. And Ziegler says that Nick, like, they marched him out of the hotel, and he's now at home in Seattle with his family. And the punishment was part of the same kind of charade of intimidation and had nothing to do with Mandy's death. It was all theatre. He says that Mandy was a drug addict who died from another accidental drug overdose, exactly like the one that Bill had treated her for earlier in the film. Bill doesn't know whether Ziegler is telling the truth, and neither do we, right?
No.
But I don't know if I believe him.
I don't know if I believe him, but at the same time, I do. think yes. I believe him because I kind of feel like in line with the film, you end up having this big like expectation of what the, you know, like the conspiracy is going to be. Like it's going to be, oh yeah, they're a secret society, they actually kill people.
And it's just deflated, right?
Yeah, it is completely deflated in actual reality. It's not as you fantasize and you expect it to be. And like, because it's completely plausible, they just go, okay, it's a big spectacle, but what wouldn't a whole load of people who are masked because of their political power, like the whole idea is that these people are like, you know, presidents or whatever.
Yeah.
And they don't want anyone to find out about this thing because it would be ruinous.
Yep.
So they're not going to necessarily kill someone. They're just going to make sure that that person leaves and never comes back.
It's potentially narratively slightly unsatisfying.
Yeah.
But in line with the themes of the movie, it's perfect. It's perfect that we get a potentially disappointing answer to all of the stuff that we've been hungrily anticipating for the build-up portion of the movie, you know. Also, Sydney Pollack, I know he's a film director, good actor in this.
Yeah.
Mad.
Plays a very believable man who's just frustrated.
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, I imagine that's I'm half telling the you job the of being truth. A director. Yeah. Apparently he like over-prepared for that scene. And he had like ideas on blocking and where he should stand, and he told that to Stanley Kubrick. So Kubrick forced him to do the blocking in a different way for all 200 takes of the entire scene.
I was going to say, it must be a very strange situation being a director working for Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It took 3 weeks to film that one scene, which is crazy. It's crazy. It's crazy. Bill returns home, and he finds the mask that he rented on the pillow next to Alice, who is sleeping in bed. And he breaks down in tears and tells Alice the whole truth about what's happened in the past 2 or 3 days. And it's the only bit of real emotional performance from Tom Cruise in the whole movie, probably.
One of the greatest cuts in cinema of Tom Cruise going, like, promising to tell Kidman everything, and then cutting to a very tired and upset-looking Kidman smoking a cigarette.
She looks devastated, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And they're just sat in silence, just looking at each other, being like, well, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And the thing that they do now is they go Christmas shopping with their daughter. Bill apologizes to Alice, and Alice is like, well, maybe we should be grateful that our marriage and mutual love survived. And says that there is something, you know, there is something that we need to do as soon as possible. And Bill goes, well, what's that? And she says, fuck. Credits.
End. Yeah.
Now, Tom, you're married. Is this what marriage is like?
Well, I'm going to be honest. I haven't actually been in this situation specifically.
So it's not like this. It's not like
no,
this
I mean, yeah, I it's a very strange one. Like I said earlier, like reality is not like the fairy tale thing that people, I think, sometimes pretend it to be.
Right.
When it comes to romance, you know, like the idea of like, oh, I'm married, and therefore I would never even fantasize about another person. And some people do talk like that, maybe not in that voice, but you know, they do act as if you know, oh, I'm married, therefore my sexuality has disappeared. Which is
right.
Bollocks. It's just, you're literally, with an occasional exception perhaps out there, they are lying.
Yeah, that feels more like a lie than the other thing. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, like, and I think they, as Nicole Kidman's one, the line before she says, fuck, is like, one night in a lifetime can never be the whole truth and no dream is ever just a dream, which I think is, I mean, because aside from a kiss with a prostitute, Cruise doesn't actually cheat on Kidman.
Yeah.
He just witnesses a lot of stuff. And Nicole Kidman obviously did not actually cheat on Tom Cruise.
Right. But then that, like, goes back to their original argument. Is like, obviously, the intention for Bill to cheat on Alice was 100% there. He kept putting himself in situations where it was likely that he was going to cheat on her, but ended up not going through with it. And is that because he's faithful? Or is that because of the random happenstance of the events that happened? It's an interesting question to leave unanswered, because whilst you can say, yeah, he wasn't technically unfaithful, he was pretty emotionally unfaithful for the whole
runtime
of the movie, you know. What do you think of the movie, like, generally? How did it land with you?
I thought it was good. It was not what I expected.
No, me neither.
Like I said, I expected it to be, you know, much more graphic, to be honest. I expected the party to lead into something far more sinister. And for that to almost be like the punishment for his curiosity. But in the end, obviously it's far more grounded. You know, like, even all the theatrics are, it's suggested that they're just a show, that it's not real, it doesn't have any depth to it. It's just it's just another fantasy from people who can afford a richer kind of fantasy than even Cruise's character.
And
so narratively, like you said, it is a little unsatisfying that it just kind of ends, but thematically it's enjoyable. The film didn't end and I didn't feel like, oh, that wasn't quite as
I didn't feel cheated by it. It just left me with a lot of questions that I think a lot of other films would have answered. And I don't think that's not even a bad thing. That's not a criticism of the movie at all.
I think that's a plus. I think that's to the film's merit that it doesn't just do the satisfying thing. Because obviously if it did have a big satisfying climax, that would be completely antithesis of the theme.
Satisfying climax. I see what you've done there.
Orgasm.
Yeah, orgasm. Yeah. Coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
So my weird hazy memory of it, and I think like from half watching it 15 years ago and from what I thought I knew the movie was about, I thought it was about a couple who have a boring marriage and then both engage in numerous instances of these like orgy party things. That's what I thought it was about, and an exploration of how that would actually tear a marriage apart. But it's not about that at all. Anyway, it's very like slow and methodical, and for a film about sex, it's wildly passionless, and it's all super dreamlike. And I really liked it. Benefit of the doubt, that is his intention, that it all feels odd. Cynical me says there's some tonal shifts because it's unfinished in some ways, but benefit of the doubt, this is how it was intended. I love all the themes. Christmas, Tom. Christmas. Even the child isn't excited for the actual Christmas. She's excited for Christmas shopping. She goes on and on and on about going Christmas shopping and the consumerist, emotionless side of Christmas. And we see a lot of ritualistic, passionless sex. And what else has become ritualistic and passionless? Christmas.
It's Christmas, Adam.
And what involves spending large amounts of money to elicit brief moments of joy? Christmas.
Yeah.
And what is all build up and hype for what is usually a relatively disappointing event? Christmas.
Easter. Oh, wait, no. I got confused there.
It's Christmas. It's Christmas. Yeah. All of that things relates to both Christmas and the sex in this movie. I also like the weird, like, prescient stuff around the conspiratorial sex parties that now, like, right-wing people love about this whole Pizzagate sort of stuff.
Right. Yeah, because it's always the left-wingers, isn't it, with their weird sex parties.
It is.
All these really cool left-wingers with their crazy mansion sex parties.
Oh, man.
And
the blood of the innocents. At no point in the movie did I know where it was going or what type of movie it was, or what type of movie it was going to end up being, which on the first watch was actually pretty exciting. And on the second watch, it made it more confusing. Subsequent rewatches, I imagine I'll gain like further appreciation for it. There's lots to decode. There's loads of discussions around the colour of the pool balls that Ziegler is handling in that final confrontation and what that could mean. Maybe the fact that the pool table is red means that actually he was Red Cloak. Maybe he's, you know, the ringleader of this whole thing. And of course, it's very like Stanley Kubrick to include exactly those kinds of things in his movies. It just
A lot of the cloaks were red and blue, the ones that weren't jet black. And obviously all of the lighting in the fantasy sequences whenever they're talking in the bedrooms.
Orange and blue, yes.
Yeah.
See, there's loads of this stuff. Stanley Kubrick's an incredibly subtle, interesting film director. Unfortunately, it takes about 20 viewings for you to even fucking work out what's going on. Have you seen the documentary that is about all the various theories about what The Shining's about?
No, I really like to, though. I haven't watched it, though.
You should. There's stuff in there about how, like, if you decode room... What's the room? Is it 237 or something?
Oh, I can...
You'll remember better than me. Whatever it is, if you decode that, you can spell out... or you can spell with something. Something is an anagram of moon room, which is, you know, a reference to the fact that Stanley Kubrick shot the footage that was used to fake the moon landing. Although, and somebody else pointed out, it's also an anagram of moron. So,
yeah. but also, the little kid, Danny, has a little rocket on his jumper, doesn't he?
Indeed, indeed.
And that can't mean anything other than the director made the moon landing video.
But that's the thing, is that Stanley Kubrick, everything is on that screen for a reason.
Yeah. He
wants you to decode these things. He probably spent a week of his life looking at different types of rocket that he could put on that jumper. And he chose that one for a specific reason. He's an interesting guy. We'll never get to the bottom of exactly what it is that he's doing with all of his films. And this appears to me to be the one that is most like a puzzle. Probably because he died before it even came out and wasn't able to talk about it at all. Some of his other films he's been able to talk about, obviously. We should get to the business of the scores and such like. I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5. I went in just assuming it would be an easy 5 stars, but there is something holding me back from that. It feels like a withholding movie. It does feel unfinished in some ways. So I'm going 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah. See, now I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. For the same reason that I think it's a very good film, but it is a little less satisfying than his other films.
It is, yes.
And it's not as if...
It's a little bit less visually striking as his other films as well.
And yeah. Because something like 2001 A Space... Yeah, 2001 A Space Odyssey doesn't have a satisfying conclusion in a traditional sense. Mm. Spoilers for the 54-year-old film. But, you know, he just ends up in some weird... Tesseract time loop at the speed of light, and then witnesses himself old, and then a baby fetus, and then end.
Yeah,
it's fucking mental.
I understood it perfectly. I don't understand what the issue is.
Yeah, but like, it's insane. It's not a satisfying ending. It doesn't reveal any real mystery as such. Like, you can kind of put the pieces together, but it's still like open ended.
Yeah,
but and yet that is a 5-star film.
Yeah,
because the ending isn't satisfying in a conventional way, but the entire experience as a whole is satisfying.
Enormously satisfying, yeah. I didn't get that same satisfaction from Eyes Wide Shut, I have to say.
No, it's like it's a very... If it wasn't made by Kubrick, we would just be going, that's a very good film, 4 stars.
Yeah, that's probably true. You know, I'm going to stick with my 4.5.
Yeah.
And I think if I watch it 5 more times, it might go up to a 5. But I don't know. You know, I don't want to speak too soon. In terms of cruiseness, very difficult. Because all of the cruiseness that he's bringing to the movie is metatextual. Everything... Do you know what I mean? Like, it's because they're a real couple... It's because his sexuality was somewhat in question by the tabloid newspapers. It's because people were fascinated by their actual real-life marriage and the deconstruction of that marriage in this film. That's the stuff that Cruise is bringing. And in terms of his actual performance, there's not a lot of Cruise here at all. It's a very flat performance. I've gone 5 out of 10, Tom.
Adam.
Yeah.
Now, before I say what my score is, I'll just read out exactly what the notes I put here. Obviously, I wrote this before we've had our discussion.
Okay, we don't pre-discuss.
It's a good film. Yeah, it's a good film and a good performance, but the cruiseness aspect is actually quite low. Mm. I don't think Cruise brings anything unique to the role, and I wonder if that's a result of working with Kubrick or his role being mostly reactive.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, he is kind of just a conduit for the scenes, isn't he, really?
Yeah. It's almost like he is the I mean, obviously as the main character to some extent, but like he is the audience surrogate in the sense that we are witnessing things and trying to put things together. But my Cruciness rating, also 5 out of 10.
Lovely, lovely stuff. And we're back. We're back to being very close to one another, having, you know, deviated briefly last week for the first and only time, I imagine. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Would you recommend it, though?
Oh, 100%, yes.
Yeah, I would 100% recommend it. I'd but probably not to be my very granddad. Careful. Yeah, I probably wouldn't recommend it to certain people. But in general, people should see Eyes Wide Shut. It's a deeply interesting movie. And I could see about 50% of the people I recommend it to coming back to me and saying, I hated that. And good, because it's not for you. What?
It's for Kubrick.
Yeah, it's for Kubrick and Kubrick only. Was it a hit, though?
Well... The budget was $65 million.
Insane for the kind of movie that it is. But you have to remember that they built two blocks of New York in London. So I guess it makes sense.
I was going to say, I could probably hire Rhinefield House for less than that. And then just stick a whole load of naked people in it.
He was that's what your wedding was like. He was so like intense about how accurate the New York sets had to be. He had people fly over to New York to measure the distance between like the gutters and stuff like that. Insane. An insane man.
That's mad.
Yeah. What did it make though?
Box office, just over $162 million.
That is quite big.
Well, it's the highest grossing Kubrick movie due to a large overseas turnout.
Yeah. And I can imagine that a lot of that was to do with Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
It's Tom Cruise's sixth consecutive number one movie.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, because $162 million doesn't sound like a lot when you compare it to like Mission Impossible or even Jerry Maguire.
Yeah.
But it is a very big amount for a Kubrick movie when you consider
the kind of movie that it is, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we look back and we go, oh, every Kubrick release must have got in the, you know, billions in today's money. But in reality, he was a, you know, very respected, but kind of art house director.
Yeah, he's an art house director. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's kind of in
He's
in
no
the
Ron
same...
Howard.
He's no Ron Howard, is he? No.
No.
He's, you know, a bit like Wes Anderson. Very, very well respected. Never going to set the box office alight, you know, a Wes Anderson movie. Mixed reviews, eh? Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I got Rotten Tomatoes gives it 76%. Metacritic just 68.
Yeah, that is obviously low for Kubrick, and a lot of the reviews at the time leveled the blame at Tom Cruise, saying that his performance was boring and that he was bad in this movie. I wholeheartedly disagree. I do think it's the reason that he doesn't do anything interesting anymore, because he put, you know, 4 years of his life, destroyed himself making this movie, and then everyone turned around and said, oh, you're bad in this. Yeah, so I imagine he was straight on the phone to someone going, right, when are we doing Mission Impossible 2 then? Yeah. let's get that set up immediately.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to fucking act. I'm going to climb a fucking mountain.
Yeah, that's the only way he feels alive now. He used to be working with great directors, but now it's just, you know, brinksmanship with death. It was nominated at the Golden Globes.
Yes. Well, I was going to say it was largely ignored come awards season. It got nominated for Best Original Score at the Golden Globes, and that's about it.
Didn't win. Yeah. That was
no.
It. The movie put...
What did you think of the music?
Good. Liked it. Was listening to the soundtrack last night when I was writing my notes.
Because I was wondering what you'd think, because obviously it's very piano-based. And after The Firm, where we did not like the oppressive piano.
It works here. It works.
Yeah, this was
great
oppressive piano.
Also, there's some great classical music being used. There's an orchestral version of Strangers in the Night, which has got very funny usage in the orgy scene. I really liked the music on this. The whole experience of the film put an enormous strain on Nicole and Tom's relationship. Around this time, they were also fighting a court case around libel. Around the fact that, oh, they had to adopt children because Tom Cruise is impotent and doesn't have sex with Nicole Kidman. And Cruise insisted on fighting that in court, which was very difficult for Nicole because she basically kind of, you know, she had had ectopic pregnancies, was potentially not able to conceive children. And it was very difficult for her to have to open up about that in public, in such a publicly accessible trial that everybody wanted to hear about, you know, because it was Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. I don't necessarily want to go into all of the tabloid fucking nonsense that surrounded their relationship. Some of their phone calls were recorded. They had arguments, whatever. Their relationship was under huge strain following the release of this movie. And this movie, I think, goes some way to dredge up all of those suspicions and rumors, to be honest. I can't imagine that doing this movie did any of that any favors. You know what I mean?
No.
So that's where we leave them. And that's Eyes Wide Shut. But before we wrap up completely, it's obviously time for our long-running game. Only one of us is allowed to look at the IMDb trivia page for each movie. This week it's me, and I'm going to present Tom, that's you, with three pieces of trivia. Only one of them is one that I've made up. You're going to have to discern which one that is, Tom, in Two Crews and a Lie. Right, so I've not been great at this. I currently owe you £640.
Yes.
What would you say to double or nothing?
I'd say why not at this point, Adam.
Okay. Well, okay, cool. I'm hoping for nothing. Obviously, if you correctly guess which one is a lie, I will owe you... Hang on. £1,280. Okay?
Yeah. A reasonable weekend spending money.
Yeah, okay. Wow. What do you do about the weekends? Right, okay.
Sex
trivia
parties.
Trivia piece number one. Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman spent so long living in the UK due to the prolonged shooting of this movie that their two children acquired English accents. It's interesting, isn't it? Number two. Stanley Kubrick and director of photography Larry Smith tested out different film stocks and finally settled on one that had been discontinued by Kodak. As a courtesy, Kodak offered to make and supply as many rolls of the film as would be needed for the project. Okay. And number three, Tom Cruise was so overprepared for the whole film because everything that happens in this film, for him, it's just a standard Wednesday night.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So there's the English accent, the film, and the fact that Tom Cruise has orgies every Wednesday.
Right,
And visits sex workers, and goes to a cafe, and a morgue.
Yeah, and is married to Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, well, that was true at this point. Well, not that the rest of it's not true. Look, Tom, which one are you picking?
Is this the reason why Kodak went out of business?
It might be.
Because they were like, this shoot's probably going to be, what, like 8-9 weeks?
Yeah, we won't need to make too much film for Stanley Kubrick.
It's not like traditional camera rolls are going out of business anytime soon. Don't worry about it.
Come on, what are you
thinking?
4 years?
Now, Adam, because I believe firmly in tabloid rumours and therefore insist, even now, that Tom Cruise is definitely gay, I can't imagine he had heterosexual orgies.
Well, okay, so you're going to say number three?
Yeah, number three just can't be true because I'm a little tabloid bitch.
Okay, fine. Yeah, that's correct. Well done, Tom.
Oh,
all right,
lucky
so
me.
Jot that down. 1,280. Okay, that's going to be devastating, Tom. I was supposed to go on holiday next year, and I'm not now.
Well, I will.
Yeah. Can I come?
No.
Okay, well, that is...
You don't have the password.
Or the money.
Yeah.
Well, that's how and why we play Two Crews and a Lie. Okay, whoa, that is the end of our episode, right? But I want to do something that we haven't done before because we finally have enough to kind of do it. Can I read out an email from one of our listeners?
Yes.
This is from David Hopkins, who emailed us ages ago, and I kept meaning to read it out, and I kept forgetting. And the subject line is, "You can't handle the a few good men takes." Okay? He says, "Hi, Adam and Tom. Loving the pod so far, having cruised over from Adam's other podcast. Our listeners Lovely. Are very funny. I'm not sure if you're hoping for listener contributions ahead of time, but I wanted to drop over some thoughts about a film that's currently a few weeks away, namely A Few Good Men." Tell you what, wouldn't it have been great if I'd read this out on the A Few Good Men episode?
Wouldn't it just?
That would have been wouldn't some incredible synergy. You may not be able to handle the takes, but I'd remind you that we live in a world that has takes, and those takes have to be guarded by men with guns. So these are some takes that he has on A Few Good Men. Starting with the positive, why isn't Rob Reiner spoken about amongst the lists of great directors? A Few Good Men came at the end of the run, taking in Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, and then there's Spinal Tap and The American President. How many other directors have that sort of CV? That's a good point, I think, Tom.
Yeah.
That's an unbeatable run of films. Absolutely incredible. On to the negative takes. Okay, so David Hopkins had one positive take, and it was Good. About the other films that the director had made.
Right.
This one concerns Cruise. Put simply, it isn't credible that Cruise gets one over on Jack Nicholson's character. Over his career, Tom Cruise has tended to more than hold his own when matched with a more seasoned actor like Rain Man, but he can't hold a candle to Nicholson, and that affects my view of the characters. I get that part of the idea is that the young lawyer finds himself and conquers the older men, but there's no way Nicholson's character would let himself get so easily baited into a confession. At least Cruise fares better than poor Demi Moore, though, who a couple of times is visibly struggling to wrap her gums around Aaron Sorkin's overly complex writing, which leads me to the main negative. Right. I'm going to disagree with David on this a lot.
Yeah.
Because I actually think they do a pretty good job of setting up that Jack Nicholson's character, like, bites at the merest suggestion of anything he disagrees with, right? A bit like I'm doing now, okay?
Yeah.
his main negative, right, is Aaron Sorkin. He says, a decent writer, but also a vastly overrated one, and there's early signs of his weaknesses here, specifically his weakness for a neat and triumphant ending. Or maybe I'm not going to disagree, actually. The film actually raises some quite interesting questions. Is iron discipline actually merited in extreme circumstances? How to balance the sacrifice of one if it helps protect the many? But Sorkin isn't strong enough to leave those questions open. Rather, the film ends with a dreadful fudge when the convicted men reflect that it was their job to protect the weak. So, you know, just be a bit nicer to everyone, yeah. Hope those takes are of interest. Look forward to more as you get closer to Eyes Wide Shut and Minority Report. Interesting. Today is Eyes Wide Shut. We did both find the ending to be a bit tacked on.
It's a right? It's a Spielberg ending.
It's a Spielberg ending. It's a Spielberg ending, and that's
you've
fine.
You've got to wrap up the themes with some clunky dialogue, try to tug on some heartstrings, salute the American flag, fade to black.
And that's exactly what I'm going to do now, Tom, as we wrap up this episode of our podcast. Thank you, David, for the email. Thank you, listeners, so much for joining us. Come and let us know what you think of Eyes Wide Shut. You can join us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Cruise Views Pod. Email us like David did, and we'll read out some of your stuff on the show. cruiseviewspodcast@gmail.com. Follow Adam Glasspool, Tom Ashford on Letterboxd. Until then, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to watch Magnolia before next week's episode. This podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.